Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. Russia's massive retaliation for Ukraine's attacks on infrastructure has moved the war much closer to home for many Ukrainians, but is it persuasive or frankly frightening enough to change the calculus not only in Kyiv but also in Washington? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Daniel Kovalik, adjunct professor of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Professor Kovalik, it's good to see you. Thank you very much for being available.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we are recording this conversation on Monday afternoon, Moscow time, when the full scope of the Russian strikes upon Ukrainian infrastructure is still unclear, although I think we can all admit that it's extremely distressing on a human level, seeing people sheltering in the subway, running distraught down the streets. But I think analytically, and as a former war correspondent, it's kind of predictable, especially in the light of Sunday's attack on the Crimean Bridge, as well as the previous attacks on the Russian gas pipelines. Do you expect further escalation at this point, or do you think it will stop here?
Unfortunately, I see this, you know, it's very possible it's going to escalate further. And I think largely because the West wants it to escalate, in particular the U.S. and the U.K., I think the whole purpose from the Western point of view for this war was to undermine Russia, to weaken Russia in the way that the Afghan war of the 80s was intended to do the same to the Soviet Union. And it did actually have that impact. I mean, it succeeded to that extent. It's my perception that Russia would be happy to end this thing now, to with those four republics that have voted to join Russia, joining Russia, Crimea staying with Russia and leaving the rest to Ukraine and ending it there.
Now, Professor Kovalik, this war has been going on for several years, but I think over the last couple of weeks, we've seen a notable moving of the goalpost, and something that used to be off limits, at least for the states. I'm talking about industrial sabotage and industrial terrorism. Seems to be pretty legitimate, or at least normalized, by the strikes on the Russian gas infrastructure, as well as, according to Russian intelligence, previously undisclosed attacks on a nuclear power plant in the Russian city of Kursk. Why do you think we are seeing such a rapid escalation to essentially terrorist tactics at this point of time?
I think the U.S. in particular, who's leading the charge here, is getting desperate. I think they see Russia winning this thing. I don't think they want to allow Russia to have a victory. And so, yeah, they're now turning to terrorist tactics. I think the attack on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline was the most dramatic. And I'm assuming the U.S. did it. I obviously don't have proof, though there is some evidence anyway. There is some circumstantial evidence. But I'm pretty certain the U.S. did do that. And what's important or dramatic about that is not only was that an attack against Russia, it was an attack against Germany, right? I mean, really, what the U.S., I think, intended to do there was to make it impossible for the natural gas to flow again from Russia to Germany, and to therefore make an exit option for Russia more unlikely. So what we see is the U.S. trying to cut off all avenues of exit from this conflict. That's what I think you're seeing happening.
Even if the United States is behind the attacks on the pipelines, it still carries or maintains a certain degree of plausible deniability. But when it comes to the Crimean Bridge explosion, I think the Ukrainians are actively celebrating it. I mean, the authorities stopped short of calling a national holiday on that occasion. And I think what adds an additional detail to this whole thing is that the explosion happened on Vladimir Putin's 70th birthday and was celebrated as a very dark present to him. I mean, it's the Ukrainians, after all, who are bearing the brunt, both in terms of casualties and in terms of the loss of infrastructure. Why would they be so eager to go along with that?
Well, the question is, who is they, right? I don't think the Ukrainian people, well, there may be some Ukrainian people happy with it. But I mean, I think you have to talk about the Ukrainian leadership who's in charge of all this. And I don't think they really care about the Ukrainian people, right? I mean, I think they are basically tools of the United States. I think they're happy to be that. And I think they see that no matter what happens, they'll land fine. Zelensky will be a billionaire somewhere on an island or something. So they're willing to do crazy things, even things that hurt their own people, to at least continue to have favor with the United States. That's how I view it anyway.
But you know that, and Russians make no secret of that. Russian intelligence services have pretty long hands, as we say here in Russia. And Vladimir Putin is usually pretty straightforward in expressing his intentions. A couple of weeks ago, he explicitly said that Russia is going to retaliate and retaliate strongly if the attacks on its land, on its infrastructure continue. And yet everybody seems to have ignored that warning. Why do you think Putin is not being taken seriously, neither in Kyiv nor in Washington?
Oh, I think he's being taken seriously. I mean, obviously he warned about the intervention in February. He said that was going to happen if these red lines were crossed, and they were crossed. Why? Because the West wants this war. I mean, let's just be clear. The U.S. wanted this war to begin with. They crossed the red lines in order to make sure the war happened. And now I think they see the escalation as working to their benefit. Because
okay, what kind of benefit? Because, I mean, we are actually talking about Russia that has pretty strong weapons, that has a much better equipped army than the Soviet Union had. Clearly, Putin has shown that he's willing to use that army or those weapons to defend Russia. What do you think is the American calculus here?
That it will trigger the right of NATO to respond more aggressively against Russia.
In what way? So have a land incursion of NATO into Russia? Do you think NATO is up for that, really?
There's probably someone in Washington up for that. I think that's probably not the prevailing view. But no, I think they want to suck Russia in further into Ukraine and to attack Russia there. Obviously, Putin is mobilizing, 300,000 reservists into Ukraine? Well, that's 300,000 potential Russian targets, right, for NATO. I mean, the more this goes on, the more this escalates, the more they're going to have the chance to take more Russian lives and treasure. That is the goal here.
There is an opinion here in Moscow that one of the key reasons for being where we are today is the complete loss of fear on the part of some Washington decision makers. I mean, the kind of fear that prevented Russia, or rather the Soviet Union and the United States, stumbling into a major nuclear confrontation during the Cold War, that fear is absent. Do you think this latest series of strikes can bring that fear back, or do you think it would be fully ignored in Washington?
I'm honestly shocked at the lack of fear, not just in Washington, but honestly in the streets of the United States. I grew up during the first Cold War. I grew up in the 70s. I grew up in the 80s. And I, as crazy as our leaders could be, as crazy as Ronald Reagan could be, they seem to at least want to prevent a nuclear war. And there was a large peace movement who was demanding that that never happen, right? Now we have leaders who seem, as you say, comfortable with the idea of a possible nuclear conflict, and we have a population in the United States that doesn't seem to give a damn. There is no peace movement that's on the streets at a time when we know, when our own president has said, we're on the verge of a nuclear apocalypse. He said these words. He didn't say he had a plan to stop it or prevent it. He just said we're on the verge. And the response was crickets chirping, as we say. Nothing. It's the most bizarre thing I've ever witnessed in my life. I mean, there's something very wrong in America. I'll just say that.
Very, very dangerous as well. You mentioned the possibility of a nuclear apocalypse. And just before the start of the Russian military operation in Ukraine, the Ukrainian politicians openly discussed a possibility of acquiring nuclear weapons, including a dirty bomb. This is something that Vladimir Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, mentioned openly at the Munich Security Conference, and none of the Western leaders commented on that, despite the fact that the world formally subscribes to the regime of non-proliferation. Given that everything seems to go when it comes to fighting against Russia, do you think there is indeed a danger that the Ukrainians will think in that direction, as we say here in Russia, that they will not stop at attacking critical infrastructure objects here in Russia, but actually go for something that would really provoke fear in the West and bring the West to the Ukrainian help in a more active way?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think for the reasons you say that I do think they're willing to do it. If you look at Zelensky's words, when he talks about that the West should engage in a preemptive strike against Russia, for example, and as you say, he's mentioned this dirty bomb idea, and frankly, the Ukrainians are already kind of carrying out this dirty bomb attempt by shelling the nuclear power plant, right, which they've been doing for months. This is becoming a suicidal conflict. And I'm very disturbed. I'm very worried. And as I say, I'm equally horrified by the lack of response by people in the United States to say, hey, stop this.
Well, this is actually a very interesting question of who is calling the shots in Kyiv. Every time there are some moderate successes on the battlefield, Washington is eager to claim the credit. But after a recent series of terrorist attacks, the Biden administration said that Kyiv is fully independent in its decision-making and target selection. I wonder how much influence do you think Washington has on its allies in Kyiv?
I think they're in charge. I think the US and UK are running this war. And yeah, I mean, they're just doing what a lot of people do in life. They take credit for the good things and they deflect blame for the bad things, but they're in charge. They're in charge for the good and the bad. That is very clear. This is a NATO operation against Russia. Let's just be very clear. That is what this conflict is about. And the poor Ukrainians are the cannon fodder that NATO is using for this conflict. That's what is happening.
Well, Professor Kovalik, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Daniel Kovalik, adjunct professor of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Professor Kovalik, despite the fact that you believe that and not only you, but I guess a lot of people around the world, that at least I interview, believe that the United States is a driving force behind this conflict, I think we can place our bets that we are going to hear lots of Western decision makers accusing Russia yet again of unprovoked aggression and gross violation of international law. Given your experience at actually litigating international law, do you think they have a case in this particular case?
The truth is, when you attack civilian infrastructure, whoever does it, that's a war crime. That's a violation of the Geneva Conventions. And I think both sides are doing it. I do think Russia has tried over the last months to avoid doing that. But now I think they feel in retaliation, they want to do that. I think there's, under international law, the truth is there really is not a justification for attacking civilian infrastructure, even in retaliation, right? There. So the answer is, yeah, there's a case to be made, for sure. But there's also a case to be made against Kiev for numerous assaults against civilians and civilian infrastructure. And there's also cases to be made, of course, for the U.S. To be tried as well in multiple theaters, right? But what we see, of course, is we have an international system that, frankly, is not fair, that generally operates to the benefit of the West and the U.S., and the U.S. acts with impunity, but others are not, right? Others are punished for what the U.S. does. So, I think we'll see. I'm sure there'll be some international cases that come out of this. My guess is they will be focused on Russia, but we'll see.
I'm sure you know that Putin is a lawyer by training, and if we listen to his speeches, he has this legalist orientation. He always tries to make a legal justification for his action, but in this case, he clearly judged that the use of high-precision weapons would be the most persuasive argument. And that makes me wondering, even if a person like Putin, who some would say in Russia has an unhealthy attachment to, you know, legalist precision, if he ignores international law, do you think international law matters at all in this day and age?
It hasn't mattered for a long time. I mean, is the truth. Let's face it. It's always been essentially the tool of the strong to rule the weak. I mean, that's a fact. I teach international law, right? And so for me to say that is kind of a huge concession, because I'm saying that the law I teach is fairly meaningless. But let's face it, it is. I mean, just to throw out some examples, one of the biggest international law cases ever, one of the most seminal cases, is the case of Nicaragua versus the United States, in which Nicaragua won a case before the International Court of Justice against the U.S. for its war that it waged against Nicaragua in the 1980s through the Contras. And the U.S. simply ignored the decision and even said, okay, well, now we're not even going to submit to the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice unless we want to. That is, we'll just decide what cases we'll be subject to. Well, that's not law, right? I mean, when you just pick and choose what laws, and we see this, you know, over and over. I think another big inflection point was the NATO war on Serbia, which had no basis in international law, which did not have Security Council authorization. And then, of course, you had the second Gulf War as well, no Security Council authorization. So international law has been, you know, it's been whittled down over time to the point that it's not impactful. Again, particularly against the stronger states, it just used against poorer countries, right? That's just a fact.
But the United States still, I think, to some extent, cares about the court of public opinion. And I think one of the time-honored methods that it uses is to sort of try to narrow the scope of any conflict and present it as a conflict between bloodthirsty tyrant on one side and, you know, this free-loving people on the other side, whom the United States supports because of the goodness of the American hearts and shared values. And we've seen that same narrative and script being tried over and over again and disproven on many occasions. But I wonder if people that you teach at university or people around you in Pittsburgh or more broadly in the United States still buy it, that the United States does a good thing for the benefit of freedom and liberty.
I think largely they do. Yes. I mean, that is what I see. It's called American exceptionalism, right? That the U.S. is this unique country. It's this beacon on the hill. It's the indispensable nation, as Obama put it. I think that is in the DNA of most Americans, even when the U.S. does bad things, even when they know that their country does a bad thing in Vietnam or whatever, they just write it off as an aberration, but believe that, essentially we're a good nation that acts, out of good intentions. And that's what allows the U.S. to get away with what it gets away with. Also, the American people, I find, are more willing now than ever to frankly believe absurdities and lies. For example, that Russia blew up its own pipeline, that Russia is shelling itself at the nuclear power plant, that, right, Russia maybe even blew up its own, Crimean bridge. These lies are being peddled constantly in the news in the U.S., and people seem to basically believe that, even though they make no sense. And that's scary, too. So, yeah, I mean, I've said for many years that the Americans are the most ideologized people in the world. And I believe that to be true.
You know, the Western way of life, Western thinking, at least in the rest of the world, is perceived as sort of very rational and materialistic. People are supposed to care about, the profits and the bottom lines, nothing personal, just business. And I think you also developed this thesis in some of your writings that, it's all about money after all, that the military-industrial complex and what have you. But if we look at the structure of the American society and the people, the consequences of the recent crisis, people are already feeling it. I mean, the chickens came home to roost. The Americans are feeling the pinch themselves. And yet, for some reason, the message doesn't land. It's very difficult to explain that from a rational point of view. So I wonder if you still believe that this war is because of money primarily, or is it perhaps led by some other God knows what motivations?
It's certainly about money. It's certainly about, lining the pockets of the defense contractors. That's a big part of it. But it's not just that. It's also about the U.S. wanting to stay in control, to be the only superpower in the world, which means undermining Russia, of course, ultimately undermining China. They haven't quite gotten to that point, but they see Russia, the road to China runs through Russia here on that score. But also they see the EU is another competitor that they want to undermine, which they are doing, right? The EU is in much worse shape than the US is. So I think it's about dominance as well and about empire preservation. The US is a dying empire. And it's desperately clinging to its empire at this point.
Okay, Professor Kovalik, we talked about the United States, we discussed Russia, we discussed Ukraine. Let's talk about the rest of the world. The Kremlin is now trying to frame its own cause as a broad fight against hegemonic neocolonialism. It acknowledges that first and foremost, it pursues its own national interests, economic and political independence and sovereignty. But I think Putin, in many of his speeches, stresses that ultimately that fight is also creating the ground for a more democratic international system. Do you think there's any support for this kind of cause within the larger non-Western world?
I do. I think, and that's being reflected in the UN votes. I mean, what you're seeing is that it's really, the US, Canada, Western Europe, Japan, and Australia, they're on their own against Russia. Really, the rest of the world is not. And even you see Saudi Arabia now cozying up to Russia.
Well, not just cozying up, but buying the Russian oil that used to be destined for the Western markets. They are buying it for rubles, Russian rubles.
Yeah, and the U.S. is furious about it. And this is one of their closest allies. So, look, here's my impression. The U.S. has been doing what it wants without recriminations, certainly since the collapse of the Soviet Union, right? It's gone to war wherever it's wanted to go to war, without Security Council authorization, And I think the world's tired of it. The rest of the world is tired of the United States. And so I think they are excited, honestly, one, from an emotional point of view, to see the U.S. getting kicked in the teeth a little bit, but also because the U.S. uses, you know, the dollar dominance to, you know, to sanction other countries, to try to control other countries. Most of the world's happy that there's another systems emerging that they can be a part of, that they don't have to trade on the dollar, for example. They're happy that they can trade with other countries like Russia and China and Iran, that they don't have to be totally beholden to the United States.
And that's actually a very important point, that that gives them a certain degree of freedom. This is a thesis that I heard one prominent Russian analyst put out, that many of those countries, they have very different social and political values and customs, but there's sort of a meta value for all of them, and that is the freedom of choice, that they, as people, can choose their own path and develop according to their own national destiny rather than American self-serving prescriptions. But I guess the last question I want to ask is, do you think Washington will ever authentically accept other people's right to differ and right to develop as they wish?
I don't see that as happening, sadly. I was more optimistic maybe at some point that the U.S. could be reformed in that way, that the U.S. could become a kinder and gentler nation, to use George H.W. Bush's words. I don't see it really possible in the near future. I think now the hope for the world is that the power of the U.S. declines enough that it stops being a threat to the world. I just think that's it. And that in the multipolar world that's emerging is part of that solution. So that's it. I mean, I think in that sense, Russia sees the conflict correctly in that way, that the U.S. needs to be checked in a way that it has not been for a long time.
Well, I hope that check happens without another world war, but before we go into that subject, let's leave it here. That would be more optimistic. Thank you very much for your insights today.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.